Okay. This is what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about atmospheric weather patterns and their structures, but more specifically, I'll talk about vortex dynamics on the surface of a sphere. And a lot of this work was done by a student of mine who just finished his thesis. Okay. So let me just go through what I'm going to talk about. I'll introduce the basic equations of motion for vortex dynamics on a sphere. I'll just briefly go through the integrable Hamiltonian theory, which plays a role in what I'm going to talk about mostly, which is here. And I'll just give you a little glimpse of the some of the relative equilibrium solutions and their stability, and probably show a little movie. But the main part of the talk is this, and that is having to do with looking at full spherical atmospheric weather patterns and making comparisons with the integrable vortex dynamics. And then if I have time, I'll talk about some other things, one of them being the beginnings of a statistical mechanics theory on a sphere and some applications to oceanographic problems. So most of this work is that I'm talking about today is in this paper and that paper. So let me just briefly show this picture. I'll come back to it later in the talk. Here's the problem that I'm interested in. If you look at atmospheric weather patterns, this is an example of a full spherical pattern. So this is a northern hemisphere. This is the southern hemisphere. And these are constant pressure curves. Sometimes you see these figures instantaneously. Other times you see them averaged over many readings. This particular example is averaged over July. Doesn't matter. I'm interested there are a lot of things to say about these kinds of figures. One is, what is the typical kinds of complexity in the topology of these streamlines in terms of the instantaneous or kinematic structures? And the other more complicated problem is, what are the dynamics of these patterns? And in particular, do they bifurcate from one topology to another as they go? And if they do, how does that affect the transport of particles in the atmosphere? So I'll get back to this picture later on in the talk. So let me give a brief introduction to the equations, which are, I think everybody is familiar with, maybe not on the sphere, but in general. So the basic equations are the 2D Euler equations on the surface of a spherical shell. The stream function is Hamiltonian, and the vorticity is the curl of the velocity field, which can be written this way in terms of the perpendicular gradient on the Hamiltonian. So the coupled equations that everybody knows are these. And in particular, a nice way to look at these from the point of view of these level curves is you take the time derivative of this equation and plug it back into here, and you get a single equation for the Hamiltonian, which you can call the level set equation. And that's because the level sets, the level curves of this equation is what we're interested in. Okay, so that's the basic equation, Euler equation 2D on a sphere. And the Laplacian is the Laplace-Beltrami operator on the sphere. Capital R is the radius of the sphere, which in some cases you can take to be a parameter in the problem, and sometimes it's kind of nice because in the limit as R goes to infinity, you can make a correspondence between some of the spherical results and the planar results. But for other purposes, you can typically scale the radius to be 1. Okay, so right away, there are a couple of differences that you see immediately on the sphere versus the plane. And I'll say more about that in a minute. The first is because the sphere is compact, the integral of the vorticity over the surface has to be 0. And you can easily see that on any compact surface just by taking a closed loop and integrating the velocity field around the loop and use Stokes' theorem, and that gives you that the integral of the vorticity in this region has to be equal to the integral of the vorticity minus the integral of the vorticity over that region, and so the sum has to be 0, which means the total has to vanish. So that's true on any compact surface, and of course that's not true in the unbounded plane. So these are the constraints, that's one. And the other is that we're interested in general, aside from the vortex motion, in terms of the streamline patterns, we're interested in the level set.
It's true on the infinite plane.
What's true on the infinite plane?
The integral of the vorticity is zero.
No, it's not. It's only.
Look at vortex.
Now, time
right, no, if you have an isolated point vortex in the unbounded plane, it certainly doesn't integrate to zero.
Okay, you're right. I'm looking at the continuous.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Another thing which is, of course, related to this, but is also related to the Poincaré index theorem, which I'll talk more about later, is that you have more centers on the sphere than you would in the unbounded plane. For example, if you place an isolated point vortex at the North Pole or anywhere on the sphere, then just from the basic streamline pattern, you can immediately see that there has to be another elliptic fixed point on the opposite side of the sphere. So you can call this a ghost vortex. It's the image, in some sense, of this vortex. And that's also not true in the unbounded plane. So in general, when you have centers in these kinds of full spherical patterns, some of them are vortices and others are ghost vortices. And
it really, what do you mean?
You really can't distinguish. If you look at an atmospheric weather pattern, you can't distinguish. They're all centered. But it plays a role in terms of categorizing these streamline patterns. Okay, I'm going to talk about the point vortex decomposition, which I know many people are familiar with. The modal representation of the vorticity in terms of delta functions. Each has their own strength. And so the Hamiltonian then is just the inverse Laplacian on the vorticity, which is the 2D Green's function on the sphere, which in this case is given by this formula. It's very similar to the planar formula, except you have this radius parameter. And the argument of the logarithm is the chord distance between two vortices on the sphere. So you can write it in terms of spherical coordinates if you like. And that then sets up your...
Do you have to satisfy your condition here, or does it automatically...
No, it's automatically satisfied here because basically, essentially what you're doing when you use this Green's function is you're setting up n vortices on the sphere,
yeah.
Then you have a constant vorticity background field which cancels the sum. It doesn't affect the dynamics, but...
Okay. Yeah.
So here's your system for the vortex motion. And as I said, at this point, once you write down this system, the sum of the gammas does not have to be zero anymore. It's all built in. Now, let's see, what can I say about it? There's a lot of things to say. I think of this as a constrained n-body kind of a problem. It's constrained to lie on the surface of a sphere, and it's an n-body problem with logarithmic interactions. It's a little bit different than the typical mechanics problems in that the Hamiltonian is not the sum of the kinetic plus a potential energy. Of course, it's the 2D Green's function. And that's, of course, true in the plane as well. Okay, before I want to say a couple more words about comparisons, there's a nice way to unify the equations on the sphere and the plane. If you write the equations sort of mimicking the Biot-Savart law in the following way, you can write the equations in this way in general, where n sub I is the normal vector to the surface at the point vortex location gamma sub I. And this formula then unifies the planar formula and the spherical formula, and it gives you sort of a nice indication of why the spherical problem is a little bit more interesting. For the planar case, of course, the normal vector is just constant and perpendicular. It's normal to the surface. And so you have these equations. But for the spherical problem, the normal vector is given by this, and it's a function of x sub I. You plug it in here, and so these are the spherical equations. Very similar to that. The only difference is the normal vector and the denominator. There's one other, or a couple of tools that I'm going to use.
Sorry, distance is distance along the sphere?
No, it's the chord distance. Yeah.
3D distance.
Yeah.
Okay.
So another useful tool, or one of the tools that we use a lot, is the stereographic projection of the vortices and the streamline patterns. So let me just tell you what the equations are for that, and then really not refer to them anymore in the talk. Let's see. So down here, let me show you this picture first. So what you do is you stereographically project from the South Pole, and that gives you the equations for the vortices and the plane, which is tangent to the sphere at the North Pole. And this is the system that you get for the vortex motion if you use complex coordinates where your origin is at the North Pole. And of course, it's different than the equations of motion if you were in the physical plane. And here's the Hamiltonian for it, which also is different. And I wrote down here the equations of motion for a particle in this slow field because that's what's going to give us the streamline patterns.
So in the point P on the sphere, that picks the triangle plane.
Yeah, right.
And Z is the coordinate of the point P prime?
Z is the coordinate of the point P prime, yeah.
Right,
x plus i, y. So the so let me just show you a typical figure, and I'll show a lot more later when I talk about the categorization. So to get the streamline patterns, you're looking really at the particle Hamiltonian for fixed vortex position. So I'm showing a case here of three vortices, and you just integrate the particle equations, and you're talking about looking at level curves of this Hamiltonian intersected with the surface of the sphere. So that's what they look like for this example, and that's what they look like in this stereographic plane. So just to mention a little bit of history before I go to details. As far as I know, the first mention of the spherical shell model is a paper by Gromyka in the 50s. And then it was studied by Bogomolov in the 70s, and then a couple of other people. But it really, people really didn't look at it that closely until fairly recently when we started looking at it, and Marsden and a student of his are looking at it, and Lim and Montalvi and Roberts are looking at the problem. So there's been a lot of papers in the last couple of years on this problem, and that's in great contrast to the history of the planar problem, which everybody knows about, goes back a long time. In some sense, the planar case is a special limit, as I said before, of the spherical problem in the limit as the radius goes to infinity, although there definitely is some fine print there, particularly if you think of two vortices on a sphere that lie at antipodes. If you take the radius of the sphere to infinity, you get into trouble in terms of this planar limit because they're going to be pushed out to infinity. But if the vortices are clumped together on a sphere, then you're pretty safe in taking this limit and comparing with the planar problem.
By the way, there's been a lot of work by David
Critchell and Angel Polvani on this. Right. I think I mentioned that. Yeah. Right. They haven't particularly focused so much on point vortices. They're doing more general vorticity. Okay. So, just briefly, let me talk about the integrable structure of the problem, because I use it in terms of categorizing these streamline patterns. So there's a canonical formulation. The key quantity, conserved quantity, is the center of vorticity vector, which has three components. Analogous to the center of mass. If you take the three vortex problem or general vortex problem here, the center of vorticity vector in general points in an arbitrary direction, and then it's convenient to rotate the system so that the center of vorticity always points along the North Pole, so that's sort of a convention that we use. There are three components of the center of vorticity vector, which corresponds to invariance of the system when you rotate around any three of the three axes. Of course, they're not all independent. And the constraint is here that each of these vectors has to be equal to the radius of the sphere. So the first obvious question is about the integrability of this problem. So you can write down a spherical Poisson bracket and write the equations in this convenient way and get the standard conjugate variables, really not very different from the planar problem. And that allows you to prove a theorem on the integrability, which is similar to the planar problem but not identical. So apparently no one had done this, so we did this. And the theorem is that the three-vortex problem is integrable for all vortex strengths, which of course is the same as the planar problem. The four-vortex problem is integrable if and only if the center of vorticity vector is zero, and that's a little bit different than the planar problem. In the plane, the condition for integrability of the four-vortex problem is that the sum of the vortex strengths has to vanish. Whereas this is a little bit more general. You do not have to have the sum of the vortex strength to vanish. You can set up the initial conditions in such a way as to cook up the center of vorticity vector to be zero.
Is it in general, how restrictive this condition is, really, on the surface?
How restrictive in terms of the motion?
Yeah.
In terms of the four-vortex problem, you mean?
Yeah.
It's very restrictive. Yeah, absolutely.
So there are three equations, and each vortex, you know, there are three equations. The equal zero is three equations.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it's very restrictive. It limits you to sort of very symmetric kinds of configurations. And
the initial data are prescribed by 12 data,
yeah.
And you have three equations.
You can see how this reduces to the planar in some way, the limit r goes to infinity.
No.
They will go on the
I haven't thought of meaning the integrable four vortex problem.
Yeah. And
I'm not sure about the correspondence in the limit as r goes to infinity for that. All right. Okay, so let me talk first about some equilibrium configurations for the integrable problem. Kind of interesting. There are two kinds of equilibria. There are fixed equilibria, where the vortices are rigidly locked, and there are relative equilibria, where they where their relative distances are fixed, but they could rotate around some vector. So the fixed equilibria, the first thing to say is that all fixed equilibria must lie on great circles, and the analog in the plane is that they are collinear, because great circles are corresponding collinear configurations. And there's really not too much to say about fixed equilibrium for the three-vortex problem. It's not that interesting. So let's see, there are sort of two kinds. They're all great circle states. If the vortex strengths are all equal, then you have to have an equilateral triangle on a great circle. So that's the configuration there. If the vortex strengths are not all equal, then in general you have either an obtuse or an acute triangle, depending on the signs of the vorticity. And this statement actually should be down here, because if the vortex strengths are all equal, obviously the sum is always positive. So this configuration is always stable, and these are sometimes stable or unstable, depending on this quantity. For the relative equilibrium, it's a little bit more interesting, and the stability is a little bit more interesting. So for the relative equilibrium, what you do is you write down the equations for the relative distances given by this, and this is the key thing here. It's the volume of the parallel pipette, or the scalar triple product of these three vectors. And so you can see immediately that for a relative equilibrium, the right-hand side, you need to set to zero. So there are two cases to consider. One is when the volume is zero, in which case the vortices lie in a great circle. Or the other is when the sides are all equal.
Does this V is an integral of motion?
I'm sorry, what?
This V is an integral of motion.
The V is an integral of motion? No.
No.
The V is the volume of this parallel pipette.
And it changes?
It changes in time. Absolutely.
Okay.
So there are two possibilities for relative equilibrium. Either you have equilateral triangles, or you have great circle states. So you can further subdivide this, and we classified this, and then Jerry Marsden and one of his students who's working on this problem and other problems did the nonlinear stability of this. So basically I categorize this into two different classes. One is the degenerate case, in which the center of vorticity vector is zero, and the other is the non-degenerate case. So for the degenerate case, the relative equilibria have to lie on great circles, and these states are nonlinearly stable. And for the non-degenerate case, you have either equilateral triangles, non-great circle states, and they're either stable or unstable, or you have non-equilateral triangle, great circle states, and they're either stable or unstable. Okay. So there's a lot to say about the general equilibrium problem, and I'm not really going to say too much. I'm going to show a movie in a minute. Let me just show the general situation for the free vortex relative equilibrium. In general, the way to visualize this is that the three vortices are moving on fixed latitude lines where the center vorticity vector is perpendicular to them, and they're all so it sets up a triangle, and the triangle is just rigidly rotating. So here's the general case. Here's the equilateral triangle case, and here's the great circle case. And this is the degenerate case. There are several other people who are looking at this problem. Let me just show this slide because it's kind of interesting. There's a group, Cheng Lim at RPI and Jim Montaldi and Mark Roberts, are looking at this problem using symmetry techniques. And so what they do is they're more interested in the end vortex problem, but they have to restrict to the case where all the vortices are equal. And so they've just written a nice paper on some of the relative equilibrium configurations for more than three vortices. So here's some pictures of three and four vortex configurations where they're all equal. One of the nice things that they do, which is kind of interesting, is they plot these energy versus central vorticity diagrams, which are kind of cute. So for the case of three vortices, the curves are not that interesting. For the case of four vortices, it's much more interesting. You have two different kinds of relative equilibrium configurations, tetrahedral and square, right? What's interesting about these is that these curves intersect, which means that at that energy and momentum, you have the possibility either of a square or a tetrahedral relative equilibrium. And for the case of five vortices, these curves get more complicated and they intersect all over the place.
So these are the cases where that C will be zero, four vortex case. This is the all integrable.
No. The C is along this axis.
Oh, C is along this axis.
So the case where C is zero is just along this axis. Now these are non-integrable in general, but I mean, of course, it's irrelevant when you're looking at relative equilibrium. You're just looking at periodic solutions. So before I show this movie, let me just mention that there is a lot of other work. There's fairly big literature on the corresponding problem in electrostatics, where you take a conducting spherical shell and you're interested in setting up point charges on the sphere in such a way that they are in equilibrium. And there's a pretty big literature on that. This is a nice little review paper on this. And for that problem, there are some techniques which give you asymmetric equilibrium patterns, and these kinds of patterns really haven't been studied at all for the vortex problem on the sphere. There's something called, in this literature, there's something called the Thames problem, which is sort of an optimization problem in which you're trying to minimize the energy of a configuration like this on the sphere.
And these patterns must depend very sensitively on that number, right? 123 will give you a pretty specific pattern.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. The pattern depends very much on the numbers. Okay, so let me show a movie that Jerry Marsden and his student Sergei Pekarsky put together of the three vortex relative equilibrium configurations. It's pretty quick. So this is really more for the stability problem. So this is a case of three vortices moving on the sphere, and we're looking at the unstable great circle configuration. And it's unstable due to numerical instabilities, but they set it up so that the vortex strength is such that it's theoretically unstable as well. So, let's see, going unstable. If it was stable, they would just be closing on themselves. There are four cases that I'm going to show here.
kink in the trajectory.
Because it's projection articulated.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right. It's a little bit, it's we're looking at the back of the sphere.
Okay.
Are they all the same sign?
No. These are, one of them has strength 3, 1, 2, and 1, 1.5. So these are cooked up so that this is an unstable case.
The sign, they're all the same sign.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, they all have the same sign. Yeah. Okay, this is case 2. This is a stable gray circle state. Here the vortices have strength 3, 2, and minus 2, so these have different sign. This one's stable.
I could have distinguished the line on the front surface and back surface with a different shape.
Yeah. There's certainly lots of improvement that could be made.
That's right.
So there is what's the relative equilibrium? The rigid distances are constant?
Yeah. It's rigidly rotating.
In the previous one, did they draw something? Did they feel the surface of the...
Oh, that is a interesting question. Yeah, it's a totally open question of whether they densely cover the surface of the sphere, whether they're, what kind of surfaces, the vortex motion is ergodic. Very interesting question. Totally open. Yeah. Okay, this is case 3. This is an unstable equilateral triangle configuration. The vortex strengths are 2, 1, and minus 1. I think this is a cute little case. You'll see the it goes unstable and the orbits follow a nice little homoclinic orbit. You'll see. So this one certainly does not densely cover the sphere, as you'll see. But there are definitely many analogies that could be made between these problems and Billiard's problems in terms of. This is a nice little instability, as I said. So you can see the bottom one is staying on its orbit, and the other two are going on this little excursion.
Is there any reflection of the intrinsic incompressibility in the flat case? Is there any thing like that?
Of the intrinsic incompressibility.
Yeah, in other words, the one area element is not conserved in this one, it's on the other.
No, I mean, it's the same. Yeah, the same.
The curved area is conserved?
Yeah. Yeah. The same. So this is case, this is the last case I'm going to show. This is a stable equilateral triangle case. And,
in the previous one, the one that is staying in the stable orbit, is it a 2 or a 1 over minus 1 and 1?
I'm not sure. I'd have to dig around and get that. I'm not sure what the color coding is based on these.
I don't think they have the same sign. As they came close, they should spin around each other, right? The same sign.
On the last one? Or on this one?
The last one.
The last one, the signs were.
Trajectories came close.
Yeah. For 2, 1, and minus 1. Yeah. So now we're just rotating it to look down from the center of vorticity. Show off. Okay, so let me move on to the main topic, and that is the streamline patterns that these flows set up. So the first thing that you have available to you is the Poincaré index theorem. If you're interested in the flow field, the vector field based on the vortices, and that says that the vector field, the index of the vector field on the surface, is equal to the Euler characteristic of the surface, which for the sphere is 2. So basically it tells you that the number of centers minus the number of saddles has to be equal to 2. And the number of centers, so let's see, so you have the vortices, and then you have a certain number of centers and saddles that are non-vortices. So the total number of centers and saddles are the all the stagnation points on the sphere plus the vortex locations. Okay. So to get the stagnation points, you look at the algebraic system. So you set the time derivatives to 0. Z sub s are the location of the stagnation points. Z sub j are the location of the vortices for the n vortex problem. And you basically have to solve this complex algebraic equation with constraints. And so I just want to extract one important result, and that is based on this this expression, you can derive the theorem that says that there are at most n squared minus 2n plus 2 stagnation points. So that is that means the number of centers and saddles, not including the point vortex locations. Okay. The only possible non-degenerate stagnation points are centers and saddles. Index of a center is 1, saddle is minus 1. So we'll skip the rest of this. So for example, for the integrable problem, so you're talking about 3 vortices, this theorem says that you have at most 5 stagnation points, plug it in there, plus you have the 3 vortices, which are also centers. So that tells you that the number of centers plus saddles for the integrable problem is equal to 8 at most, and the number of centers minus saddles is 2 by the Poincaré index theorem. So you solve this, so that means that these are all possible situations you can have. Okay? So if you want to classify the topologies of the streamlines, you just have to go through each of these cases. So let me go through some examples, and then I'll show you the classification scheme. So for example, here's an example of one of the stable fixed equilibrium topologies. This is an isosceles triangle, 2 saddles and 1 center. This is the front of the sphere and the back of the sphere, and this is a stereographic plane, what the streamline patterns look like. This is an example of a stable fixed equilibrium, isosceles triangle, 3 saddles, 2 centers, front, back, stereographic plane. And a couple of the relative equilibrium streamline patterns. These are all the stable relative equilibria. These actually are the front of the sphere, so these are four different cases. Another one, this is now the streamline pattern in a rotating frame. So you have a relative equilibrium, you locate yourself, you're looking down from the center vorticity vector, and you move in a rotating frame, which is moving at the same frequency as the relative equilibrium, and that gives you the streamline pattern. And I'll just give a couple more examples, and then I'll get to the main part of the talk. Here's an example of streamline patterns when a sum of the vortex strength is 0. Here's for the 2 vortex case, here's for the 3 vortex case. And then, of course, there are streamline patterns for the non-equilibrium problem, which is much more interesting and relevant. So let me just show one or two examples from that. So here's a case, this is a non-equilibrium situation. This is actually, these are the vortex trajectories. This is a special periodic solution that we can get analytically. So here's the front of the sphere, back of the sphere, and here's the no sphere, so it's just on the surface. So this is the vortex motion, periodic. And you can ask yourself, what are the streamline patterns associated with that? And what's interesting about that situation is that the streamline patterns evolve, and you get a topological bifurcation, which you can see, here's the front of the sphere and the back of the sphere at a quarter of a time period. There's one stagnation point. And three quarters of the way through, here's the front of the sphere, There are two stagnation points, and here's the stereographic projection, two stagnation points. So through one full period, it goes from one stagnation point to two stagnation points. And that's obviously an interesting thing in terms of mixing, and clearly those kinds of things happen all the time in terms of these atmospheric patterns.
How does that work? How can you change topology continuously?
The topology depends on the vortex strength, and it depends on the relative positions. So the vortex strengths are obviously staying the same, but as the relative positions move, the streamline patterns evolve. So if you just look at the instantaneous streamline patterns, right. So you get some kind of a topological bifurcation in the streamline patterns at critical times. It's an interesting problem. It hasn't at all been explored. Okay, so let me now go to the main part, and that is to use this to say something about these atmospheric weather patterns. So if you do this systematically, and you go through and you look at the integrable problem, and you go through all possible configurations, all possible combinations of centers and saddles, which I showed before, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, versus 6, 2, 1, then you can come up with a chart which gives you all the integrable streamline patterns. So what I'm showing here are the number of saddles, 0, 1, 2, 3, and all possible configurations with those numbers of saddles. And what I'm showing here, the numbers here are the number of homoclinic, heteroclinic, and triheteroclinic orbits. Now, there's a comparison you can make here. In 98, there's a paper by Areth and Bronze where they do a similar kind of categorization for the planar problem. And for them, they can only get these configurations because you can only have two saddles for the planar problem. So these patterns are specific to the spherical problem. You can then, there's another difference between the spherical problem and the planar problem, and that is that you can take each of these 12 patterns and you can homotopically deform them on the sphere and get a different pattern. So for example, if you take the figure 8 and you push the sphere through one of the loops, you end up with this figure, which is homotopically equivalent to that, but there's a different streamline pattern. Whereas in the plane, these two patterns are distinct. You can't get one from the other by continuous deformation. So you can then take each of those 12 patterns and do all possible homotopic deformations, and that gives you this equivalence chart, which gives you an additional 23 patterns that are possible. Okay, so you're looking at you're looking at the 12 patterns here, which were on the previous chart, and all possible homotopic deformations on the sphere. These are all distinct patterns. So you have a total of 35 patterns that you can construct from the integrable problem, instantaneous kinematic structures. Okay, so what does this have to do with the problem I showed in the beginning? So this was the spherical streamline patterns I showed at the beginning. So you can ask yourself which of these patterns show up on those charts. Okay. So at first pass, you would expect there wouldn't be very many because obviously this comes from a turbulent problem, and I'm doing an integrable classification scheme. It turns out it's quite surprising. So you do this decomposition. So in this particular example, there are 10 connected components where you have a structure. So the black are all the centers, some of which are vortices, some are not. You have no way of knowing. And so, for example, in this component, you have two centers, and so you connect them with a figure eight and one saddle. And so you can ask, what is the topology of the streamline pattern in each of these components? Well, so in this example, here's the global decomposition. You've got 10 connected components. In this particular example, you have 22 centers and 20 saddles, so you have 42 total. Turns out, here are the 10 components, that it's incredibly simple. I mean, all of these patterns show up on the integrable streamline chart. And the only two that don't are these two. And these you can get easily from the integrable four vortex problem. Okay. So it turns out, and I don't think this is specific to this example, I've looked at several examples now, that almost all the streamline patterns that you get are basically you get from the integrable structure. And that's despite the following fact that from this estimate, which is this, n squared minus 2n plus 2 is the number of centers and saddles, plus n, which is the number of vortices. So this is the total number of centers and saddles. With 42 of these, you have to have a minimum of 7 vortices in order to create them. Despite that, you still have very simple instantaneous structures. So that was a little bit of a surprise to us. Okay, so there are a couple more things I want to say. Let me mention one other direction that we're going with this. If you want to apply this to oceanographic situations, then you have to deal with the presence of boundaries on the sphere, which create a more complicated problem. So for that problem, you're looking at surface of a sphere with some kind of a solid boundary, and you want to know what the vortex motion and what the streamline patterns are there. And in general, you could either use the method of images if your domain is very symmetric, or you could use some version of a Riemann mapping theorem, which apparently hadn't been, at least I didn't know about it, on the sphere. So one of the things that we did recently with Eugene Gutkin at USC was we proved a version of the Riemann mapping theorem on the sphere. So basically it says this, that if you take a closed domain on the surface of the sphere, you can conformally map it to the upper hemisphere problem. So basically the upper hemisphere problem is the key problem to solve for the vortex motion. And you do that in the following way. Here's the proof. You basically stereographically project it up here, and the stereographic projection is conformal. You then use the Riemann mapping theorem to map it to the unit circle, which is conformal, and then you inverse stereographic project it back down, and that's conformal, so the combination is conformal. Okay, so...
cartographers must have known.
Maybe. Probably. I haven't really looked into
that. I know that for sure... well, and then we can discuss. There were some problems with cartography, like trying to hide bad points and make put all the errors in points that nobody visits, and that's done by using some.
Right, I haven't really looked at that literature too much. Okay, so here's basically the fundamental problem, which is the fixed latitude problem, which is equivalent to the upper hemisphere problem. So this is a solid boundary. Here's the vortex trajectory. It just moves on fixed latitudes. And here's a streamline, typical streamline pattern for one vortex in this upper cap. Not too interesting. So we've done several examples of this. Let me just run through them. The longitudinal wedge where you have great circle boundaries. This is a streamline pattern. This is the vortex motion. Here's the comparison about, this is the vortex motion in the stereographic plane, this is the vortex motion in the physical plane. You can see they're different, obviously, and that's because the vortex motion on the sphere is bounded, whereas in the physical plane it's unbounded. Not too surprising. Some more complicated ones, great circle triangles. Here you can use the method of images. Here are the streamlines, and here's the vortex trajectory in a great circle triangle. And a great circle rectangle, streamline vortex trajectory. And the obvious thing to do, which we haven't done yet, but we're moving towards, is to do a spherical analog of the Schwarz-Christoffel mapping, where you think of any arbitrary closed domain on the sphere as being made up of pieces of great circles, and then you conformally map that to the upper hemisphere. Probably a little bit messy. Okay, so let me wind this up. Let me just say one thing about why we think these streamline patterns are as simple as they are, and that has to do with statistical equilibrium theories that have been worked out. I'm sure at least one person in this crowd is familiar with this work. the easiest point of comparison to make with a spherical problem is the one that Poynton and Lundgren worked out in the 70s, where they looked at vortex motion in a circular domain, so that has the same symmetries as the sphere. Obviously, there are other differences, boundary conditions and so forth. But in their problem, they worked out the Finch-Poisson equation as the basic equation governing the eigenfunction for the average streamline. And once you arrive at that, then you're basically looking at eigenfunctions which are relatively simple. And so you can think of possibly these atmospheric weather patterns of the type I showed, since they're averaged over many days, you could think of them as maybe being set up by some kind of statistical equilibrium. So we have worked out the analog of that theory on the sphere. This is joint work with Igor Mezik, and we pretty much followed it closely, the Poynton-Lundgren approach, except for the spherical Hamiltonian. And there are really no surprises. Skip this. You end up with the same Finch-Poisson equation for the spherical problem, but of course, now the Laplacian is the Laplace-Beltrami operator, and so what we haven't done yet, which is the next step really, is to compute the eigenfunctions of that problem on the surface of the sphere, and presumably they're going to be relatively simple, and they're going to be in some way analogous to the circular problem. So in some sense, if you look at it from this point of view, it shouldn't be that surprising that the streamline patterns are relatively simple, even though the flow is turbulent, because you're averaging over many of them. Okay, so let me stop and just put up some conclusions. So some of the conclusions are this, that in some sense, the averaged turbulent streamline patterns shown in the chart are, in some sense, show integrable instantaneous structures, somewhat surprising. The equilibrium statistical mechanics theories predict that these are Finch-Poisson eigenfunctions, which we haven't yet looked at, as I said. So you're sort of forced into this situation that the turbulence on the sphere has to manifest itself in terms of the dynamics of these relatively simple patterns. Patterns are simple. We know it's turbulent, so it has to be in the dynamics of them. So basically, the key issue is to study the bifurcations from one simple pattern to another, and to understand how those bifurcations affect the transport of particles and the mixing on the sphere. So it's really an interplay of the geometry of the simple patterns and the dynamics. So that's the direction we're going. Okay, so let me stop on that.
When these streamline shapes undergo these topological changes,
right,
children,
right.
Could you say anything about the relative position of the vortices at those moments, in other words?
I can't say anything generally about them, no. I mean, all I can say is that at any instantaneous time, the patterns are going to be in those charts, but it's going to go from one to another.
In other words, is there any, you might say, coherent configuration when these things take place? Obviously, there is a change and they take place. We'd be interested to know that.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know the answer to that.
I was going to ask something very related, and that was, can you say that the bifurcation can occur only when a vortex passes through a critical point of the either the string function? Okay. In other words, can you characterize those situations under which there is no topological change because it's just a smooth transformation?
Okay. I sort of see the question. We can characterize the bifurcations in sort of two general categories. One type of bifurcation is the case where stagnation points collide, and the other is where you just get some kind of a homotopic deformation, so of the type that I described, like a figure eight going into a laminate state. It probably does have to pass through.
Either the two stagnation points collide or a vortex passes through a stagnation point.
Probably. That's probably the case, but you certainly have these two general categories where during a bifurcation you lose stagnation points or you don't lose stagnation points. And those are clearly two very different kinds of things going on. I don't think we really have a handle on any kind of a general statement at this point.
Can you identify a parameter, like a bifurcation parameter, in terms of which you could characterize these changes in
pattern? It's really not a parametric bifurcation problem. It's really a dynamical bifurcation problem. I mean, all the parameters are fixed, and the flow is evolving, and it's bifurcation which evolves based on the internal dynamics of the system.
Time is a parameter.
Right. Okay.
Have people studied flow on other surfaces? Or
there's a little bit of literature on that. There's a paper by Halley in 1980 in Journal of Mathematical Physics where he studies, he writes down the equations of motion for vortices on a general curved surface, and then he studies particular examples on surfaces of revolution. Mm-hmm. Kind of a nice paper. And then there's a recent paper by Kimura where he studies certain examples on surfaces of constant curvature, and three examples being the sphere, the plane, and the pseudosphere. And there's lots of interesting things to say about that.
What's the pseudosphere?
The inverted, the Poincaré disk.
Constant negative
curvature. So here's an interesting thing. In the plane and on the sphere, if you take a vortex dipole, so two point vortices of equal and opposite sign, mm-hmm. then they're going to move on a geodesic which perpendicularly bisects the line joining them. So, for example, you take two equal and opposite vortices in the plane or on the sphere, you connect them with the geodesic, you draw the perpendicular bisector, then they move on geodesics on the sphere and on the plane. And the question is whether that's true for general surfaces, whether dipoles are going to follow geodesics. And it's not really known, although it probably is true. And it's sort of interesting because there are these surfaces that have been constructed recently in the last couple of years by people like Burns and Donet, which are embeddable surfaces in R3 for which the geodesic motion is known to be ergodic. And so for those kinds of surfaces, dipoles would ergodically cover them, which would be an interesting thing.
If you could establish that the
dipole moves along a geodesic, which probably is true but hasn't been proven. So that sort of relates to your comment in the beginning. It would be sort of a non-perturbative proof of a ergodic vortex motion, which would be really nice, but no one's done.
You said you had some pictures on spherical salt bubbles of
your
video.
Yeah, well, let's see. Maury Garib has done some experiments on soap films.
Yeah.
And he told me a couple of months ago, you were present in that.
He had
done the experiment on a spherical bubble,
yeah.
And he has nice pictures of vortices moving on a sphere.
He
said he has a videotape of it, and it turns out the only copy he has, his student took with him, and so he's trying to track down the student and get the videotape. So I hope I get it before people lose.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, I would too.
But any vortices or the
how do you set up the thing on the soap bubble? I think that I'm not sure whether he blows little spurts of air in order to set up little vortices on the sphere, or whether he drags pins through the surface. I'm not really sure how he does it.
That's something like the Ohio State soap film 2D experiments.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. He certainly has other surfaces where he's done this.
Like pieces of comb or something.
Yeah, pins, I think.